This is the podcast that we ask our guests from in front and behind the camera, how did they get their foot in the door? What was the key to unlocking their success? What's their story?
Our guest today is a Golden Globe winning actress whose versatility has seen her thrive in some of Britain's best TV and film, including Downton Abbey, the smash hit Liar, and one of my favourite movies, Filth. We chat about her leaving her parents at a young age to pursue acting at Red Roof School of Performing Arts, starting up her own production company, and her new ITV drama, Breathtaking. Our guest today is actress Joanne Froggatt.
I'm curious to hear how you kind of, you know, you're here now and you've done so many great shows and great films. How did it all begin? Where did that passion come from for performance?
I'm not sure. I think I was born with it, honestly. None of my family are in the industry at all or in any kind of performing arts or music or acting or any of those sort of careers. So I grew up on a farm in North Yorkshire, in a tiny little hamlet in North Yorkshire. But I remember my mum saying that when I was two, I asked if I could go to ballet lessons. And she was
"Wow.
Well, ballet? I was like, I want to go to ballet. And then my brother is 4 years older than me, and my parents, because we lived on a farm, they had a small holding, so they worked from home. So we were with them, but they were always busy working. So my brother was often tasked with looking after me. So we used to watch a lot of movies that were all probably a bit too old for me, because he's 4 years older. And I just used to be mesmerized by these adventures that these people were having.
What kind of movies would it be, just out of interest?
Like the 80s. So it was
great movies.
Yeah, great. The best movies.
The best.
Yeah. So anything from, I mean, what did we start? I mean, goodness me, like such a wide range, from Gremlins to The Goonies to Stand By Me to Top Gun to American Werewolf in London.
Like, amazing.
Like
kids' films then.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, something completely inappropriate. American Elf in London, I was obsessed with. Not when I was four, I was probably about seven when I watched that.
That's okay.
It's fine. I just remember being mesmerized by all these adventures. And as soon as I could sort of get to grips with the fact that this wasn't real life, this was somebody pretending and you could do that for a living, I just thought, well, that's what I want to do. End of story. When I was sort of 11 and started secondary school, our head teacher was very into drama, David Bradley his name was, and he set up an out of school drama group which was connected with the Theatre in the Round in Scarborough, which is Alan Ayckbourn's theatre. And so I started going to that when I was 11. And then I heard about the Stage newspaper at that drama group. I don't know how it had come up, but...
You sound very resourceful for an 11-year-old.
Yeah, I was pretty resourceful. So I got my mum to ask the news agent to order in the Stage for me once a month. I'd heard there was auditions in there. So I'd look and, you know, there were sort of open auditions for musicals or dancers on cruise ships and things. But there was also adverts for Stage schools in there. And I was like, it was like a light bulb moment. I was like, that's it. That's what I have to do. I have to go to stage school. Mm-hmm. So my parents were like, okay, whatever. We'll see. They just said, oh, well, you know what? If you want to do it, you find out about it. We're not going to help you. Well, you know, just you carry on. If you want to look into it, off you go. Because they didn't want to sort of tell me no, because they thought it would make me more determined. But they also just thought I'd maybe just forget about it. So I wrote off to all these stage schools, got prospectuses, decided on the one I wanted to audition for, wrote off, got an audition. My mum took me down, which was like 6 hours away from where we lived in Berkshire. And then I ended up getting a place at the school. So then my parents did have to get involved, and they couldn't afford to pay for the school fees and the boarding fees. So I had a long process then of trying to get a grant from the local council that my dad's and mum stepped in, helped me write letters for. So eventually I auditioned for the council, got a grant for the school fees, and then my parents paid for the boarding fees. So it took about 2 years from having the idea to getting there. And then I finally went when I was 13, nearly 14.
And was that Red Roofs?
Yes.
Yeah, it was. That I mean, it's one of those places that's, well, I don't know if it's famous, but I know of it because I know people that went there.
you.
Yeah, and it must be, was that kind of, were you suddenly like, oh yeah, when you got there, were you like, this is it, I'm in the place to be?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Not the place to be, but I just felt at home with the people. I was like, oh yeah, I get this. Like this is me. Not on the first day when no one could understand what the hell I was saying because my accent was so strong and everyone had gone off at the end of the school day to be a part of a play that I wasn't in because I'd only just joined to do rehearsals. And I remember walking home for 20 minutes to this house I was boarding with three of the girls in and a woman that lived there. It wasn't just us, there was an adult. And letting myself in on my own and just bursting out into tears down the phone to my dad going, I'm homesick. I didn't know what this feeling was before. Like, oh, just awful. And my dad sort of said, oh, don't worry, you've tried it, you don't like it. We'll come and get you. We'll be there in 7 hours. And I just said, oh, well, I'll wait till the end of the half term, which was a month. I said, I'll give it a month. If I still feel like this, I'll come home. Not literally within a week, I just loved it. I'm still friends with my friends that there was only seven of us in our class, but we're all still friends today. It's like 30 years of friendship, so gave me a lot of opportunity as well as a lot of great friends. So
That's amazing at that age as well to be like, I'll give it a month. I'll give it a month. Your dad's like, just come home.
yeah, you broke your heart. You broke my parents' heart actually both times. Yeah.
I read somewhere, and I don't know if this is true, but was your first role in Heartbeat as an extra? Is that it is? Oh, okay. I was thinking that was.
Yeah, so I don't count that as my first role because I was an extra, but that was when I was still living in Whitby and I was about 12. And me and my mum, they came around to the school and me and my mum were extras in Heartbeat. My first sort of role was playing an underage sex worker in The Bill, which I got stage school. Yeah, so that was my big break.
The
So
bill
imagine
is a
my
rite of
parents.
passage.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine calling my parents going, guess what? I'm going to be a sex worker. They're like, oh, we're so proud. I know.
Your dad was upset before when you wouldn't come home, and now he's like, oh
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
God.
no, but yeah. So it was, it, but it was a really great starting point. So,
And I mean, you've had a really kind of diverse career, all the different jobs that you've done. I mean, going from Downton Abbey to Coronation Street to Filth, like all these, like they're so different. Do you enjoy kind of playing different roles and being versatile? Is that kind of, do you enjoy that?
yeah, definitely. It's definitely part of the sort of zest for what I do. I love the challenge of discovering a new character and I love doing different accents and yeah, I love creating this new person. It really excites me and it's what keeps me interested. And once I've sort of feel like I've covered that ground, I kind of not say you never want to cover it again, but you're sort of always looking for something that's just a different challenge, a new challenge where you go, oh wow, that would be really amazing to sort of embark on creating that person. So yeah, that definitely keeps me motivated.
Yeah, before doing my homework for this interview, I was obviously very aware of your career and things you'd done, but I wasn't sure what accent you would have. I was kind of like, what's she gonna sound like? Because everything I've seen you in, you're kind of different, so I wasn't sure. And then it said that you were born up north, and I was like, ah. And then I saw a clip from the Golden Globes, and I was like, oh, okay, your accent sounds quite southern. Well, I say it sounds southern, to be honest, but it was that kind of part of being in performance. Was that something that you, was it just kind of, I don't know, how did that come about?
Just naturally adapted because because I lived so left I left Yorkshire when I was 13 really. I went home on holidays but and then I started my career so early 16. I never fully moved back to Yorkshire. So obviously I went to school in Berkshire for 2.5 years. Then I ended up in Manchester on Coronation Street for my first sort of big job. From 16 years old I was in I was in Manchester until for 18 months till I was 18, and then I ended up living in Nottingham for 10 years. So I've got a bit of a Midlands kind of twang, and then since then in South. So it's just naturally evolved. So I still say grass and path and all of that stuff, but
It's
that
quite
was it.
handy in a way, though, because you've kind of been all over the place as well. So you must have, picked up accents along the way as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, because I basically with you know what it's like with typecasting and playing different roles and everything else. I did a soap for a while. I was in Hollyoaks, and I found it really difficult after that to then kind of go into auditions and make people believe that I could do something different for a while. It took a couple of years to kind of get away from that. Did you, I mean, it doesn't really show on your CV because it looks like you've just worked continuously, but did you have a moment after you came out of Corrie where it was kind of difficult to do something different?
I think the timing of my age actually was re really fortunate with that, because I did have a really fortunate run. So I got my agent when I was on Coronation Street. I didn't really have an agent. I'd still was sort of with my agency from the stage school, but once you'd left school, it wasn't really a thing then. You sort of moved on. So I sort of winged it and ended up, in Corrie, and then that ended, which was actually perfect timing. So I was still a child. So then when I was 18 and I was leaving, my agent was really had so much foresight with where he thought my career could go. And so I still looked very young, but I'd had this incredible experience, this incredible set, which was, that was like my drama school. You really had to put the work in. You don't get rehearsal time. I had this incredible work ethic instilled in me from doing Coronation Street. And so I had a lot of filming experience in a short space of time. So I had a really good run of playing these amazing, very different roles, playing sort of teenagers and tearaway teens and stuff in different, some amazing TV drama, because I don't think there were many people around of my age that had any experience. So that definitely helped me. But I did, there's definitely been times in my career over the years that I've had the same thing. You have these natural stalls or hiatuses almost, where you're sort of moving either age brackets or trying to pe change people's perceptions of you, kind of shift into a new area or a new kind of role. That sometimes you have these years where you just go, oh, you're like, oh my goodness, what's happening? Like, really quiet. What is happening? Was that it? We're like, is that my career done? And then there's a shift, and you just have to. Just have to sort of grit your teeth and get through those times and just keep that belief, which is not easy to do at times. But yeah, so I've definitely had those moments.
Those age bracket things, no one warned me about that one. That was suddenly like, you kind of, I was always playing the young kind of guy, the boyfriend or the whatever. It was always that sort of thing. And then suddenly they're like, but you're in your 30s now and you're not that young, but you're not that old. It's kind of like, and no one really warned you. And then you're suddenly like, oh, I'm not going for the, I'm going for the dad now. And then it's kind of a weird, it's suddenly you're like, oh, right, okay, I see. I've got gray hair now and now I've got to go in and do something a
There's
bit
that
different.
in between bit where they don't know where to put you, so you're just like in between bits, the quiet bit, and you're like, oh my goodness, what the hell's happening? But yeah, it's definitely a thing.
do you have like, well, because we're sponsored by BetterHelp, and a lot of actors come on this show, and not only actors, but people, directors, producers, people that work behind the scenes as well. And I think it's so important to talk about the downtime and in between those jobs. Do you have like hobbies that you, or something, maybe even writing or anything else that you do in between jobs that keeps you kind of sane in between
Yeah,
work?
it's definitely much better now than when I was younger, because I've started a production company, and I'm developing a lot of stuff now as well,
Oh,
and trying to get
amazing.
projects off the ground. So, as that keeps you sort of very busy, and although it's not paid until you get something off the ground, it is creative and it's positive, and you feel like you're moving forward, or at least you're trying to move forward. You're having creative conversations a lot, so that. That's sort of developed over the last sort of say 6 7 years, 7 years maybe, and definitely in the last sort of 5 years, that's been really great for me actually, and I love the process of trying to get something off the ground and developing a project. It takes a long time, but
I can
before
imagine,
that,
yeah.
yeah, before that there are times where it's a struggle, and I think there. It's always the way, isn't it? You try and tell yourself when you're having a quiet time, enjoy it, make the most of it, because at some point you're going to be working again, and then you'll be. But also, it depends on people's situations. Well, financially, it can be incredibly stressful. If people have to take a second job, or it's that decision: do I take a second job? Do I do this? What do I do? I'm really fortunate that I've managed to earn a living purely from acting since I was 16. But there's been times where it's been so touch and go, you know, earlier in my career, say my sort of early 20s and stuff, when I was at that age shift between teenage. I was like, oh my goodness. And it's hard. I think it's keeping a purpose, whatever that is, whether it's, you know, just whether it's just as simple as watching film, if that's what you like to do, or going to dance class, or going fishing, whatever it is you like to do, looking after a friend's kid, what, I don't know, anything that just makes you feel like you've got some purpose and that you're sort of giving something back in some way, or that you're sort of your energy's going outwards rather than inwards. Because I think it's so easy for actors where we can be so introspective and we kind of have to be, but those downtimes when there's not enough going on, that can really turn in on us as well. Think it's just getting that focus outward, you know.
100%. I think that's exactly why I did this podcast. I started it a couple of years back and I was like, I get to talk to people that I admire, but also I get to, like, it's almost like having a bit of therapy, get to sort of chat about, you
You'll be
know,
like, I've been through that.
you're gonna come off this call drained. You're gonna be like, oh God, thank God that's it. No, I really admire how you've taken control of your career and the jobs that you've done, and feels like you've made clear choices. Is that something you've done, or is it just, has it appeared like that? But it feels like you've really kind of picked and choose the jobs that you've done.
Yeah, I have to an extent, to as much of an extent as I can. I do, you know, I do say no to jobs. Yeah, I've said no to plenty of jobs because it's just not what I want to do at that time. And that doesn't mean that the job's bad. It just means that maybe it's just too similar. Because, you know, it's like you do a role and people perceive it as being successful, or it is successful, or they think you've done a great job in it. They go, oh, she was really good doing that. Let's get her to do that again. And if you don't sort of stop that at some point, if you're fortunate to be able to, you know, have the money in the bank to do so, if you've saved your pennies, then you forever are sort of get trapped in that cycle, I think. So there are times where you do have to be really strong and say, I can't cover that ground again. I've just done it. I really need to look for something else, and I really need to be brave and sit and wait for the next thing that really piques my interest, or that I feel is going to really challenge me, or, you know, me something fresh to work on. Having said that, you know, you also have to pay the bills. So it's always the balancing act of all of those things. But I have tried to, as much as I can, yeah, my choices have been choices rather than just sort of rolling with it. But there's definitely been those times too.
Well, it's a bit like, I don't know if you've random tangent, but it's kind of from what you said there. I don't know if you've read Matthew McConaughey's book, but he.
I've got it on my Audible to listen to, actually, and I
Have
have.
you?
Yeah, beautiful.
It's really good. It's really good. You'll
Really
enjoy
does.
it. But
Yeah.
he talks about, I'm not going to now spoil it, but there's a little moment where he talks about how he decided that he had to go and kind of make a change in his career and not do so many romantic comedies and kind of almost hold off and say no to everything until it stopped. And then he could do, you know, Killer Joe, or do, you know, a film like
Likewise.
Dallas Buyers Club kind of thing. And apparently it was like 3 years, 3 years of, and people just wouldn't, there was no films that he wanted to do. And it just shows you, it doesn't matter what level you're at, that you can get pigeonholed. And if you're not careful, you kind of just end up going down that one track and no one wants to kind of experiment. It's kind of terrifying, really.
And there is so much, you know, and unfortunately, there is still so much pigeonholing in our industry. And it makes sense. Of course, it does. Because, like you say, Matthew McConaughey is amazing on all those rom coms. So, of course, they wanted him to do rom com after rom com, lots of money for everybody. But, like you say, he was like, I can't do this. I've got to, like, take this risk and shift things. And I think, you know, if and when you have the opportunity to do that, and it feel if that is burning inside you, that feels like the thing you need to do, then just try and listen to it, you know.
And I mentioned earlier that I watched the video of you winning your Golden Globe for Downton Abbey, and I did, but I mean, didn't realize until I watched it, I was like, oh my God, you were up against like the big dogs as well.
Wow. Oh my goodness. This is the most shocking moment of my life. Thank you so, so much to the Hollywood Foreign Press, A, for letting me be one of the nominees amongst these amazing women. I just had a moment meeting the wonderful Kathy Bates. Thank you, Kathy Bates, for that. You were so generous. I'd like to thank Julian Fellowes, our brilliant writer, for giving me the responsibility of this storyline. After this storyline aired, I received a small number of letters from survivors of rape, and one woman summed up the thoughts of many by saying she wasn't sure why she'd written, but she just felt in some way she wanted to be heard. And I'd just like to say I heard you, and I hope saying this so publicly means in some way you feel the world.
But you were just so down to earth, and it was such a refreshing moment. But did you, I mean, was that, you looked genuinely surprised.
I was absolutely shocked. It was the biggest shock of my life, the best and biggest. Yeah, I mean, it was all absolutely genuine. I didn't think I had a hope in hell of walking home with that award. I mean, you know, why would I even consider that I would be walking away with that award that night? I just was like so thrilled with, you know, the nomination. And I'd had a lovely chat with Kathy Bates in the loo previously, bumped into her. She was so lovely to me. And yeah, I mean, I was just kind of going, oh, okay, well, it's the awards early in the evening, so we get that out of the way, the stress is gone, and then we can just have a lovely evening. I was with lots of colleagues from Downton. And yeah, when they announced my name, I actually started clapping because I just...
You're like, yeah.
I didn't hear my name. And then it sort of slowly dawned on me, and I was just like... I mean, my brain just went completely blank other than I've got to go to the stage. That's all I could think. And then you walk down past all the big movie stars to the stage, and then you're just like, you know, but I just sort of said what was in my heart, really. I just said the things I wanted to say. I know I referenced a letter that a viewer had sent me about their experiences of sexual assault. And I remember in this letter, it just stuck with me so much because she'd said, I don't really know why I've written to you, but I suppose in some way I just wanted to be seen. And we'd already finished doing the press for that series where Anna, my character, had been sexually assaulted in the series. And it just stuck with me so much. I thought, if I ever get a chance to speak publicly about this again and it's appropriate, I really want to reference this woman's letter because it really sat with me. That gave me the opportunity to sort of be able to say, you know, I've seen you. I hope me saying this on such a big stage means you feel like the world's seen you. But so that was a really special moment as well. But it just came out. It wasn't like something I'd pre-thought about it many, many months before, but I hadn't sort of thought about it, you know.
Amazing as well to put that on such a big stage as well, in front of all those people, and to have, as you say, it was kind of off the cuff, but like, good for you for doing it as well. Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/lifeandfilm, where you'll get episodes early and uncut, amongst other treats. And don't forget to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you enjoy this episode, please leave us a positive rating. Add us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok at Life and Film Pod, and find our video episodes on YouTube by searching Elliot James Langridge Life and Film. Essentially, please like and subscribe everything. It makes a huge difference. Thank you. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you work in the film industry? Are you freelance? Or perhaps you have a 9-to-5? No matter what you do, mental health affects us all. I struggled early on in my career with the uncertainty of if and when I would ever work again, struggling to pay my bills, or simply with anxiety. Don't know about you, but being an actor, it's very important for me to maintain structure in the down times. And I found not only exercise, but talking to someone for me was a game changer. And so Life in Film has partnered with BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm.
And back to the show.
We will make sure
the NHS gets all the support it needs.
Morning. Just had a call from LAS. Might be the first one.
I'm not going to make it home this weekend. Sorry, it's just... it's madness.
There's currently no PPE at all.
They were overwhelmed. The virus is always going to be ahead.
Trust the guidelines.
This is insane.
Where's the keeper? Where's the cash trolley?
The public can be assured that we have a clear plan.
There's no plan.
Members of our team are wearing bin bags and going home wondering if they're going to die in the night.
Don't go there.
We're already there. You know this thing is spreading. They just keep coming. But no one is giving up.
Prepare for the worst. But hope for the best.
Breathtaking. Starts the 19th of February on ITV1 and ITVX.
But yeah, I essentially watched the entirety of your show in one go. Really enjoyed it. It's a very traumatic performance. How did you prepare for, you know, it must have been a pretty heavy shoot.
Yeah, it was an incredible experience actually, because you know, the whole ethos of the show from beginning to end was authenticity and trying to make it the most real portrayal that we could. Very much from Rachel Clark, whose memoir it's based on. She's a consultant doctor who was working, he's still working in the NHS, but was also working on the front line during the pandemic. And our other two writers, Prasanna Puanaraja and Jed Mercurio, who many people will know from Line of Duty, amongst many other things. The three of them, when they were writing together, you know, sent the script off to doctors and nurses and HCAs and asked them, you know, is this in line with your experiences? Is there anything that doesn't feel authentic? Mm-hmm. Rachel had obviously lived it herself. We had our hospital is fictionalized and my character's fictionalized to be able to incorporate different stories into one hospital. But every single story in our drama happens. So every patient story is based on an actual patient. Every patient story happens somewhere in the UK. So again, with that comes this great responsibility, obviously because of the subject matter, but also because of our very important ethos of the show to make it as absolutely realistic as possible. And of course, as an actor, you always want to do that. But I had to, you know, be believable as a consultant who's been doing this for 20 years and, you know, put a cannula in with her eyes closed. And so it was, there was a lot of research, a lot of talking to Rachel. We had incredible medical advisors, Tom Petty and Andrew Cinnamon, who had also been working on the front line during the pandemic. We had 2 days medical boot camp where they gave us a crash course in medicine. So we understood what we were saying. So when we were talking about a blood gas, they'd say, you know, the blood gas can be this, but it depends what this reading is and how the two go together. And it was all these intricacies to sort of understand. And then we had a rehearsal week, which really sort of turned into a sort of 5 days of intensively running the resus scenes, just the physicality of it, and trying to get to grips with the equipment, how you would touch a patient, how you talk to a patient, what you're looking for when you look at a patient. So you're not just coming into a room and having a conversation with somebody, you're chatting to them, but you're actually looking for their vital signs and you're looking for this. And so it's all this sort of detail that was embedded in there, and also the little moments of humanity that you know, I wouldn't have known about, I wouldn't have thought of probably as an actor, that Andrew and Tom and Rachel were able to impart that knowledge on us. For example, in the first episode, there's a scene where I pronounce a patient deceased, and in the back of an ambulance, and I remember Andrew that day saying, you know, when you pronounce the time of death, you might do something like just put a hand on the patient's arm, or, you know, just as a mark of respect. Mm-hmm. And it was those little moments that to me were so important to make it feel real, to make us really feel like we were those people in that environment.
Mm. Well, I mean, for me, obviously, I'm not in a medical profession, but watching it just felt totally real. And I mean, some of the performances and also the characters that you're dealing with and you're treating, it just, yeah, it really kind of, yeah, it really got to me. And it is those little intricacies and those little touches and those little moments that kind of bring everything together as a whole, I guess. I mean, it must be shooting something like that. I mean, the pandemic was now, beginning of the pandemic was 5 years ago. Is it almost 5 years ago? Which is
Fourth, yeah.
kind of crazy. Because we kind of lost a few years there. It doesn't feel like it could be that long ago. Was it kind of, it must have been a bit surreal, like going back in and
Really
wearing a
surreal.
mask and all of that.
Yeah. It was a really surreal experience, actually, and the way we shot as well, which was Craig Viveros's idea and sort of brainchild, that he wanted to keep the energy of the situation. So it was his idea. We actually shot in this disused university building, and we had three floors of the building, which were three wards. And they were built in real time. The lighting was 360, so there was no setup time for lighting. Craig, decided to shoot sort of, very, sort of handheld. Everything's handheld, so there was no hitting marks. It was very much them sort of following us, reacting to the situation. Ran a lot of scenes together. So Reese us ran into this, ran into the next scene, which again just added to the authenticity because, they don't have time to stop there. There's emergency after emergency after, it's just like you're hit with something else and something happens that you have to deal with. So all of that environment we filmed in just added to the authenticity for us as actors as well, because some moments I remember saying to Bav and Honor and some other actors during the first week, I think we all had moments where we just went, whoa, this just feels so real. It's so surreal because we're in this building that looks like a hospital and everyone's doing everything that they would be, and we're doing these long shots, and it was very surreal. And an incredible experience, actually.
Yeah, in terms of like obviously you mentioned there all the kind of medical speak and all the little touches that you had to kind of put into each of the scenes there. I always imagine that must be a little bit of a nightmare, having to learn not only big words but words that you have to get right. It's not that you can kind of get it close. There can't be much improvisation when it comes to medical terms. What was it like kind of getting your head round that kind of speak? Because it's not kind of the everyday, is it?
Just practice, practice, practice. I was, we filmed in Belfast, and I did a lot of walking around my apartment, like miming what I was doing with my lines, because as actors, there's a running joke with actors, they go, oh, I'm fine with my words, but as soon as I have to walk and talk, it all goes out the window. So this was a lot more than walking and talking. So yeah, I just had to really like the lines. I mean, I always try and work like this anyway, that I know the lines so well that I don't think about them. Because to me, if I'm thinking about the lines, I'm thinking about the wrong thing and I'm not giving the performance that I should give. So I just made sure the lines were so embedded that they're not on my mind at all. I'm just thinking about what I'm doing and I'm just reacting and being in the moment. But it was just a lot of practice beforehand. Yeah.
I can imagine. In terms of, moving forward with new projects now, and you say you've obviously got your production company, and is that now kind of part of doing a job? Do you like to sort of go through your production company? Are you creating your own projects to star in, or is it more like you're creating projects for other people, or how does it work?
Yeah, to start with, definitely projects for me as part of the package, because I started to think, if there's certain things I want to do and the opportunities aren't just being handed to me on a plate, how do I make them happen? So if I have an idea or have a story, I'm just trying to sort of get that off the ground and trying to sort of, develop that in some way or another. So I'm sort of partnering with more established production companies, and I've got a few things in development with different companies. But very much, I'd love to do more on film. I'd love to be back on stage again in the not too distant future. Yeah, and I don't always have to, I think I don't always have to be sort of a producer on things. It depends what's appropriate for the project and how the project comes your way. I just really enjoy that side of things, but I'm open to everything, really. I just like to sort of, see what comes my way, but also not just sit and wait for it. I think it just helps me feel a bit more proactive as well.
Mm-hmm. What's the name of your production company, just so I know?
It's called Insight Pictures.
If you could give advice to your younger self, the kind of very headstrong, apparently very strong-willed 11-year-old, what advice would you give yourself?
What advice would I give myself? I think just to not worry too much about other people's opinions.
Mm.
I think which comes with age anyway, but I think to just, you know, trust your instincts and don't get distracted by other people's noise. Most embarrassing moments, yeah. Really goodness, where do I start? So one that springs to mind is I'm not a singer, okay? I'm not a good singer at all. And people say that and they are, but I'm really not. And I remember going to audition for a play that Victoria Wood was directing. And I'd done an episode of Dinner Ladies that she obviously
wrote. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Many moons ago, like when I was like 21, I think. And a few years later, in my mid-20s, she asked me to come back and audition for this play. And it was one of those where I think I was working on something at the time. My agent had sent it through like the night before. I didn't have a lot of time to look at it. And the character sings cabaret. And the way it was written, I thought it's this girl that's kind of wants to be a star, but she's not really very good. So I thought, okay, that's fine. Great. And the scene they gave me to read was like singing cabaret. So I sat down at this table with lovely Victoria Wood and the director. I think it was Jeff Posner actually who was directing. Sat at the table and went into this full-on rendition of terrible rendition of cabaret and literally carried on the scene, finished, and literally it stopped and they were just like and then nobody said anything and they were just like shell-shocked. And I said just to clarify, that she's not really supposed to be able to sing very well, is she? And they just went, well, she's supposed to be able to sing a bit, yeah.
Oh, no.
I'm so sorry. I said, I've wasted your time. I've wasted my time. And I literally burst out laughing. And we just kind of just went, I went, thanks. It was really nice to see you, Joe. I was like, yeah, thanks very much. It was mortifying. And I hate singing in public anyway. So, yeah, that was...
Oh, my God. That's amazing. That's amazing. That is one of those things where you just think, you've just got to go for it. And you You obviously did.
Yeah. See, not every, you know, no one's good at everything.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Jan. And genuinely big fan. So it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. It's been lovely chatting. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And good luck with the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you to our guest, Joanne. And thank you to Personal PR. And as always, thank you to our sponsor, BetterHelp.